And what I'd like to do is go through a couple of steps. One is to talk a little bit about Christian parenting, what we mean when we say Christian parenting. Talk a little bit about, just briefly about the fact that we tend to parent the way our parents parented us. And that our kind of like our baseline parenting is the way we were parented. And how to make changes from that if we wanted to. And we could spend a whole session just on that. And I'll just be touching a little bit on some of the issues that I think are important to be looked at. And then I've talked about goals of parenting before, and in a kind of a real skeletal sense, and we'll flesh that out a little bit and looking at what the goals of parenting are. And then get more into the specifics of pedagogy, particularly something that's called poisonous pedagogy, which are those things about parenting that we're kind of told are the keys or are important about parenting, that culturally are tended to be forwarded as the basic assumptions about parenting that really are poisonous, that are very, very problematic to us as parents in terms of our relationship to our children, but in particular, they're poisonous to our children. Poisonous pedagogy is supported by false information about children, about parents, about the nature of life and relationships. And we'll look at some of those. The false information is a piece that, at least in my mind, Holden Village is all about. It's helping us get rid of the false information that we have, the homophobia that we feel, and the false information that we have about that, the false information we have about sexism and racism, the things that are provided us in the culture. It's those same kinds of things that we struggle with that we also have that are laid into us in parenting. So that's the direction that I'd like to take. And then if we have time at the end, I'd like to take a look at the issues in the Abraham and Isaac story with him. I hope we have a chance to get at least to the start of it, because it's one that poses some difficulty in understanding issues of parenting. Before I start, I did garbology this morning, and it was interesting because it's the first time I've done it, and though I do it a lot at home, some similar things, just not quite the same magnitude, I guess. But it, as I was doing it, it dawned on me that issues around child abuse are kind of related somewhat to garbology, particularly for the child, in that, number one, it's relentless. Number two, it takes a lot of hard work to work it through. But if you do it well, if you do the work, that you get this gorgeous humus in the compost that comes out of it. Particularly the composting piece is what dawned on me, is that you take this thing that's garbage, that's basically been rejected and not usable in any other capacity, and through the process of working with it, and it's hard work, it's not easy work, and then with some time that goes by, and you mix it with things, supportive things, nitrogen, and you mix it with the support of others and the care of others, and you can come out with a product that's useful. It's a hopeful sign for me on issues of abuse. Issues of abuse are with us. We've all experienced abusive situations, whether they be with our parents or through friends or through just whatever it be. I don't think there's a person that grows up that doesn't come across some form of situation where that is abusive. And using that, we, with a lot of hard work and support of others, we can make it into something positive. And we can be the support for others who are struggling with it to help them compost their gardens. Christian parenting is a term that I think is flung far and wide these days, and it has some elements to it. I'd like to get, what do you feel Christian parenting is? If someone were to say, I'm really into Christian parenting, what do they mean?
I think it has
kind of
negative connotation. At least for me, I always seems like they're very God exists, and rules, and...
Fundamentalist?
Fundamentalist, yes.
So anyone who labels it as a Christian parent, you see as somehow there's a need to call it Christian as opposed to parenting, is that, and so that it's the fundamentalist piece?
Yeah.
Okay. What does that fundamentalist piece mean? How do you, what is, you say that that has negative connotations. What do you mean by that? Or, and other people too, if you...
Lots of law.
Lots of law, okay. Rigidity, is that a word?
Extreme.
Extreme. So I, yeah.
Well, I guess I think of it in terms of values that Jesus taught, and in terms of wanting my children to be giving and to be accepting of other people. Maybe
okay,
that's
so you
what
see
I
it as,
focus
you see it as
on.
A positive side,
yeah.
In terms of not so much the requirements as the
right.
as the relationship to people,
and as yeah, and as an example,
as
an attitude, like children to be involved in activities in church that are serving other people.
Okay.
I think if it said Christian based as opposed to just Christian, it would probably have a different.
So,
effect on how
so Christian based is a different term. Christian based parenting is a different term than Christian parenting.
It shouldn't be, but that's how it's
that's
interpreted.
Okay. Anything else? What about the concept of the gospel? We use Christian in a term that basically, at least as I see it, is a faith related, that the term Christian means faith in Jesus or belief in Jesus as the Son of God, that we're children of God through Jesus, and that there's a faith element to that. Is that, in terms of Christian parenting then, is there also a faith aspect that's connected with parenting?
Sure, it's not just our job, it's shared.
Okay.
So it's not just his job, it's shared.
Right. Okay. So Christian parenting is not something that we see that clearly defines anything. And what makes the difference then in terms of a person who identifies himself as a Christian parent, how they would likely to interpret that?
Maybe the way they interpret Scripture.
Okay.
The passages that they choose to validate how they operate within the family. There's lots of ways that you can look at Scripture.
Okay, so it's the Christian parenting. Does the Christian apply to the parent? Or do you think the Christian applies to the
method
of parenting?
Can you separate the two?
Yeah.
Can you separate the two? Good question. Can you separate the two?
Well, in my family, and what it, maybe this will answer, my mother was raised in a Catholic church, and she's a bit of a rebel, and when she was about 13, she had a confrontation with a priest, and visited, and has not been again, crossed the threshold of any church except to come to our wedding. Mm-hmm. However, their marriage and their family philosophy is very Catholic, and they were raised very scripturally, though she did not say that, but everything that she was taught in those first 10 or 15 years that she was involved in the church stuck,
mm-hmm.
And she married for life. They've not been married for 68 years or so. It has not been easy, but they were very responsive parents. We were taught to honor your father and mother, and we were taught to do all the things that I can see as a Christian community really endorsed, but she would not say that they by any means raised us scripturally or according to Christian ethics.
Yeah. So that's So the concept then, I guess what I'm saying is that there is something that somehow we can touch base with that is Christian parenting. It may not be the same for all of us, but there's something that if we are Christians, that there are some things within our faith or within the belief that would apply to the way that we parent. That is a driver. So parenting isn't something out here that we suddenly get out of our Christian and that we come here and parent. Is that a reasonable? So that the Christian part of the parenting primarily flows from who the person is that's parenting, and how, and what their understanding and what they're taught and how they see Christianity. I would offer that as a key item in the part of us that creates a parenting pedagogy, okay? And that's the part that we listen to that's in the broader world and understanding of what parenting is influenced by a faith, whether it be Christian or not. It's influenced by a sense of that there's a level of understanding of the world and what the world is and a higher being within the world that is kind of beyond thinking, that is a part of an assumption about the universe or about the world in which we live. Okay? Another piece that comes in that may or may not be the same as that is the way we were parented. Our experience as a child, like you talk about, scripts us with many, many things in terms of who we are likely or who we will become and who we are as adults. That the child within us plays an ongoing important part in our in how we view parenting. And there's a couple of things about that child within us that's real important that we recognize, is that there's often portions of that child within us that we cannot access, but that's in like a cellar, that we have repressed things. And more often, those things that we repress are the abusive things, or particularly the things that happen where we have feelings a certain way as a child, and we're told not that we can't express, or that those feelings are basically told by a significant person, usually a parent, that we're not to feel those feelings. And that comes in the larger context of our family and our parents' view of what children should be, so that and whether or not it's okay for children to express feelings. And if there's not permission for certain feelings to be expressed, in most families, there's at least one layer of feelings that's not appropriate for children to express. Some families have, it's not appropriate for children to feel. But other families, there's maybe a certain type of feeling that may be repressed. But those repressed feelings are a part of the child within us, but we can't necessarily access that part of the child within us, though we may act it out. And some people will say we will act from those. There may be particular emotions that we, even as adults, have a hard time expressing. I grew up in a family that was very wrong to express anger within our family. We had to be happy and cheerful all the time when we were together as a family. And I didn't feel happy and cheerful all the time, but I sure put on, you know. So I learned, and I had to, as an adult then, when we got into our marriage, you get situations, you get angry. I had to learn and really work hard at being angry, because as a child, I had a terrible temper. And that temper came from all this stuff building up down there, and all of a sudden it would just explode in fits of temper. I'd break toys, and I'd break books over my brother's head, and things that were really, I didn't know where it was coming from. And so as an adult, I had to learn. And part of it was learning to socialize. Part of it was realizing that the way I dealt with anger was gonna lose something real important to me, which was our marriage. We were not gonna survive if I didn't somehow change the way those explosive kinds of incidents that I would reach a point where I was basically out of control. And it's not an incident, but it's a process. So those things are in all of us. Those pieces that we're missing or that were repressed from childhood. The way we make changes in terms of the way our parents parented us is very consciously, very deliberately, and with lots of hard work and lots of seeing it as a process. It reminds me, we live up in Soleil 10, and there's a screen door there that slammed shut. Some of you probably know that. And the first five times out, I would walk out, because our screen doors at home all have closers on them. So I'd walk out like this, and I'd get to the top of the stairs, and bam, the screen door would slam shut. And so the first couple of times it kind of startled me, and then I began to realize that, well, it was a gradual process. I wouldn't get quite so far before I'd remember it, and I'd go back, but it would still slam. And then the next time, I'd get it, just catch it, just before it slammed, you know. And then gradually, now as I'm going out, I've got myself trained. It's a process, right? Got myself trained, so as I'm going out, I'm holding on to the door. And you know? That's the way it is with changing parenting. It's not something that happens just because I think I want to be different. You don't change because of thinking. You change because of reaction. So that as we changed in a decision that we made in terms of not spanking Anne Marie when she was about 3, the decision that we made was a firm decision that we made, but it took us some time because both of us had been spanked, though I was probably spanked more than you. It took us a gradual kind of time where we eventually weaned ourselves of needing to spank her. But it was a process that we were in. So the changes in parenting come with that kind of process. It's the composting. Let's look a little bit more at goals of parenting. And again, this is what I came up with. And it's certainly open. There may be glaring gaps there that you guys can identify and things that are important goals for you. But let me kind of briefly go through them. And as you have things to add or whatever, please join in. First is in moral and spiritual development. And what that means for me is, as a parent, providing opportunities for moral and spiritual development. You don't just teach kids to be moral or to be spiritual, but that what it means is that as a parent, my job and a goal that I have is to create situations where our children can have opportunities to make moral decisions, to talk moral kinds of decisions when we have a family, when we're at meals, to keeping discussions open, to part of maintaining a connection with the church. And then a goal is to be sure that we have opportunities when we're driving or when we're sitting around or whatever, having opportunities to talk about the spiritual aspects of our lives. As parents, to be willing to share those things that are important to us. Second of all, a clear structure and reasonable consequences. And it's like my vision of it is that our job then is to set around the child, and it's depending upon the issue, but you set a box of parameters and say, this is the limits. And depending upon the age, it gets larger as they grow older. But the things that they can and can't do within these limits, okay, is their choice, how they operate. They are in their room, for instance, and a parameter that we might put on them is you can make your room as messy as you want, but before you go to bed, your room will be picked up. So that's a kind of parameter that you can put around a small child, say, that has lots of toys. They like to go from one thing to the next, and rather, it's part of that rhythm that I talked about yesterday. You can set up some kind of rhythm. It's a clear structure, and then reasonable consequences if they don't follow through. with it. And that may be that if they have a particular thing that they play with that they have left out, that that thing is at the end of the day and they've fallen asleep or gone to bed or whatever, and then that thing may be taken out of the room and they can't play with that the next day. And it sets up, again, just the concept of a structure around them. Mealtime and toileting, especially for small children, is probably the two most stress-producing areas. And statistically, they're the two most likely places that a child will die in their home. In terms of the most instances of child fatality for abuse, occur in those two areas. So those areas are stress producing, we know that. But helping, you know, setting some structure around those with reasonable consequences that are related to those areas. Again, understanding that a small child is still, the job of say a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old is still experiencing the world, and they're very tactile. So they're, even though they may have the ability to use a spoon, they're still going to be using their hands. And that may be, you know, in terms of the parameters you put, that it's still okay. They're still experimenting with the world, and it's fun to feel squash, you know, ooze through your fingers. And that's an experience that they're doing. And instead of then us having some real narrow expectation that they have to stay clean during meals, and they have to get all the food in their mouths, you know, setting a parameter in such a way, making it easier for yourself, getting a large cloth or something put under their high chair and let them go to town. And then at the end, you clean them up and you set them down. But again, I mean, that's part of setting kind of a structure around it that allows them the opportunity to function within in a reasonable way. Opportunities for decision making, and that's kind of all related. And that's part of the box thing too. Is then if you make this box, yes, they do have to wear clothes to school. You know, but what they wear to school. Sometimes we as parents we impose our feelings in such a way that we really like this dress, but the child may not. And so we would like them to wear this dress. But every time we try and get them to wear this dress, we end up in a power struggle with them. And the primary reason for power struggles with children is lack of choices. What happens with a power struggle is the child is naturally exerting who they are into a situation that they feel that they can't express themselves. And they have lack of power. Relationship is continually a balancing of power issues, okay? And even in relationships of a very large parent and a very small child, they will exercise what power they can. And temper tantrums are one, you know, crying, refusing to get up, refusing. I mean, those are all instances where the child is trying to exercise power within a relationship. And so decision making does two things. Number one, it diffuses that sense of power struggle. It diffuses the sense of power struggle, but it also helps the child learn the skills that they need to learn to make discerning decisions. And that if our goal is that we want them as adults to be decisive, to be able to make decisions, we have to give them opportunities at whatever level they're at to make those decisions. So the decision-making practice, as well as the diffusing of the power struggle, is part of this decision making and creating opportunities for it, letting there be having our parenting be such that those opportunities are there. Self-esteem, big word, big word that is probably it's a difficult word to define, and it's often the one that's most interfered with, and we'll talk a little bit more, most interfered with by poisonous pedagogy. How I see it, in terms of providing a means for the child to develop self-esteem. That's the goal, okay? It's not, our ultimate goal is that the child will have self-esteem, but our job then as parents becomes, how do we develop situations where the child can have self-esteem within those situations? It's part of creating the structure as well. It's part of thinking through so that the child, and making the choices that the child can feel good about the choices that they make. That's one aspect of self-esteem. But what self-esteem brings, as I see it, is the child feels lovable. The child feels connected and in knows that they are a valuable person, that this person spends time with them, that this person talks to them and relates to them, listens to them, and that the things that the child says to the parent are important to the parent, that those are reflected. That's part of being lovable and being valuable. That's the second one. Child feels they are valuable. An important part of the machine that we call family, an important part of this community, and that from early on, from when they're in the crib, from when they're being held, that value that they is a part of the family. I saw a neat thing at breakfast this morning, and I don't remember who the children were, but there was a little tiny, probably a one-year-old or a little bit less, was sitting in a high chair, and the table had filled up too fast, so the father and the small child were at the one table, and the rest of the family was at the table behind this child. So this child had to turn around like this, and he had some brothers who were sitting in the chair right behind him, and his dad went to get the food for this baby, and the little boy came back with a big bowl of cereal, but he hadn't put in the milk yet. So he sat down, and he then got up and he walked right by where this child was, and this baby reaches out, and he just had a big grin on his face, first of all, when his brother walked by. And then as this boy walks by, he reaches out like this, and the little boy holds up his bowl. The baby grabbed a handful of the Cheerios that he had in there, and the little boy then just stood there and talked with the baby until the dad came back. And I thought, what an example of the concept of value, that this child feels an important part of this family. That's the kind of sense of value that happens within relationship. Feels part of a community. Same type of thing. The value comes from being within a community, being a part of a group. And it's something that we talk about as lacking when kids move into gangs. And we'll talk about that later this next week if you are going to be here. But the issues about gangs have to do with the lack of a sense of community that many families miss. They don't have that time when they or structure their world or their lives in such a way that they have, that they all get together at some time during the day so they can see themselves as a family, see themselves as a community, and that the small children can get a sense very early on that they're a part of a larger group. They don't fully begin to act on that in terms of what their job is until about three. That they begin to learn, three and four, their job is to learn that they are an individual. And that's when they ask all the why questions. That they learn that they are different and they want to know why things are the way they are. Very important for children to feel safe. And basically the things above, lovable, valuable, and in community, are all things that are key pieces in the child feeling safe. That it's important that they feel that safety. And and again, this is a piece that becomes real problematic in families where violence is a significant part of the dynamics and relationship within the family. Where you have violence, it's difficult to feel safe. And violence is a response that more powerful people do to the less powerful people when they want them to change behavior. Or if there's an inconsistency and an uncertainty around reaction. If sometimes, and again, this is what often happens around substance abuse families, where children learn at very young age to be able to stand over here, know that dad's coming in,
and immediately. That he's not, then they come out and then it's not an issue. And again, that's one of the pieces that we learned from the dynamics of alcoholic families and the work that was done by persons such as Claudia Black, who really gave us insight into dysfunctional families around alcohol. And finally, in terms of self-esteem, and again, it's part of what it draws on all the other four. Is that the child feels capable. You know, part of being valuable is being able to contribute, and that they have something. And again, our job as parents, in terms of developing opportunities for developing self-esteem, is creating things within the structure of the family that the child can do and can do well. And it takes some thought. It's sometimes real hard work. Nathan, I think, was the one that, when he was growing up, used to love to play with the pots and, or we have a drawer with the plastic containers, like cottage cheese containers and that kind of stuff, and the lids. And he used to love to take those out and put the lids on, because the lids were in one drawer and the things were in the other. And he would stand there for hours while Barbara was doing it. And it wasn't something that we needed to have done, but it was something that he was capable of doing. And to this day, he loves when we have something and Barbara and I can't find the lid. Hey, Nathan, would you find the lid?
Yeah!
Digs into the bottom drawer, and he usually finds the lid. So the concept of self-esteem is, and there may be some others that, you know, that are part of that, but those are the ones that I thought of. And finally, providing support. And again, it can be built on some of these others around issues of support. But how I see support is primarily by having genuine respect for the child. And that's not something that can be fabricated. And that's something that part of what I think we struggle with is that portion within us. If as a child we did not feel respect, it's difficult to draw on. I used the term at the end of the session last time of Swiss cheese people. It's tough to draw respect for others, particularly small children, if as small children we did not receive respect. It's hard to do. But it is part of that composting process. And we can learn to do that if we value it and if we set it as something that is a goal for us in terms of attaining. Secondly, is in part of respect for the child is respecting the child's rights and boundaries, and there's a difference there, at least for me, respecting the child versus respecting the child's rights and boundaries. The boundaries again are a relationship issue, the right of the child to have quiet time or to be by themselves. The right of the child to express their feelings. If they express the feeling that they want to be alone now, then respecting that as a wish that they have. If we expect them to respect our desires, I just come home from work, I'm exhausted, it's been a particularly bad day, I need 15 minutes by myself. And my child is excited to see me come home. The child comes in, I am not in a position. I know that if I relate to this child right now that I'm going to explode or that little things are going to set me off and I need to just settle. And so if I then can ask my child to respect my need for 15 minutes to kind of wind down and get myself pulled together, then I have to be able to in recognize, and that's part of the respect of their rights and boundaries, that they have those same kinds of situations when they've had a fight with their little friend who's their best friend. And they don't know how to deal with it, and they're really angry and really upset, and they just want to center themselves. And they go off, and rather than me imposing myself and trying to solve this thing because I want them to be good friends, if they say, I don't want to talk about it now. I mean, it would be real easy. I'm quick. I can probably convince them and trick them psychologically into thinking that they should deal with that now. But, and we may not have a lot of time, and oftentimes there's pressures for us to do that. But understanding that if we do that, that what we're losing is the child's understanding of their ability to be an individual and to have a certain right of saying, I want to be left alone right now. Another way is by demonstrating tolerance for the child's feelings. I think one of the things I know that I struggle the most with, and still struggle with, is when a child has strong feelings, as we all have strong feelings, and we express them, that oftentimes those strong feelings come into conflict with how I want them, how I want the relationship with them to be. And so they may come across with a statement in anger that sounds sassy to me, or sounds like it's directed at a person or at me in such a way that really makes me feel uncomfortable. But understanding that this is not necessarily who the child always is, but this is a feeling that they have right now, and respecting their ability to express that, and not at that time put them down for expressing it. We can go back later, perhaps, and talk with them about that feeling, and when you express that feeling, that there may be other ways that they can express it that don't alienate other people. But again, that's a process, and a lot of it has to do with that child within us and how we experience parenting. Most of those instances are spontaneous instances that we don't think about. They're reactions. And the reactive kind of parenting is parenting that comes from that child within us in most instances. So respecting the child, showing tolerance for the child's feelings, it doesn't mean we have to tolerate their behavior. And we can make strong statements about that their behavior, if in their anger, their chairs are falling over and they bump the table and spilled things, that we don't have to tolerate behavior that's disruptive, but we can, in the process of expressing that the behavior needs to stop, that we understand that they're angry, and it's okay to be angry, but you have to be able to express your anger in a way that does not destroy or disrupt the community, or become you don't step into over someone else's boundaries in terms of the things that are theirs. Helping them understand that feelings, having the feelings is not bad, but it's learning how to express those feelings in a way that is not destructive. And then the final that I have is being willing to learn from the child's behavior. Some of the things that we know about children are things that we have lost in our language, in our emphasis on language for communication, and our emphasis on time, thinking chronologically and linearly. In that children are experiential learners, and they don't think chronologically. They think, I don't know if this is fully the proper use of the word, but they think existentially. They think based upon the power, the emotional impact of an event, and that those are the events that are nearest to them. And they experience things not so much verbally as they do by the vibes or the intuition that they feel, the attitude, the voice inflection, not so much the words. Those are the ways that children gather information about them, particularly as they're small children and just moving into verbal. This plays a real problem within the legal system when we're dealing with prosecution of child abuse and where the child needs to testify. And we're still working very hard within the system to help judges and juries understand the differences between adults testifying, having linear thinking and verbal, a strong verbal base, versus children who think, who don't think chronologically and think emotionally and experientially. So so that when a small child, a 3 or 4 year old who has to testify in a sexual abuse case, the defense attorney says, well, when did this happen? And so we have to train our prosecutors and also the special advocates who may be with the child to help the child understand that, you know, what was going on around your family at the time. Well, our Christmas tree was up. I remember that, you know. Or I remember that we had just done some Easter eggs. Those are the kinds of things that the child will connect with, not a linear sequencing in terms of dates. And also, they may relate, it may be the first incident that was the most traumatic, and that's the one that they grasp. But they remember that it also happened around Christmas. And so it plays havoc with the legal system in terms of, because the law says that you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that a specific incident occurred, and it has to be as to the date. And we're working in terms of getting judges to understand and to understand that if you can get the child to identify some of those types of things, that's sufficient. You don't have to have it be a specific date. So we learn about what it means to be children. Part of learning that, if we pay attention to it and if we open ourselves to it, we can learn about that child that's within us, that many of the stuff that we've repressed and pushed down, that we don't have to let that come out in an authoritarian, angry, or come out only in the times when we react to problems. That we can learn to draw it out in times that are the nurturing times, the cuddling times, the warm body together times. That those are the times, if we learn to draw on that and understand our children at those times, that's the bonding that occurs that will see us through the problem times. An example, not related to parenting, but related to neighborhoods that I've noticed, that when you have a child in a neighborhood that you've watched grow up through the 2-year-old and the 3-year-old, and you've been a neighbor to them and related to them, and they say, hi, Mr. Eckler, or hi, Bruce, and they're really cute, and then they grow up and into 6, 7, and 8, and then kind of into the awkward 11 and 12 age, when you really kind of struggle with their relationship, and they may be somewhat misbehaving or some kind of, you're not really sure, but having had that experience of them in this loving time, it helps you get through those times when you may have the conflicting experience. You know? So that's an important bonding time. And you know what? That's as important. They never show it, but that's as important for the child as it is for the parent. Because when they get into that awkward time and the time of beginning to emerge into adolescence where their job is separation from the parent, that it's safety to the child to know that they're loved. They may not think it right now, but they hold on to it with all their might when they're beginning to move out and beginning to separate over here and beginning to say, this is the huge black void over here of which I know very little, you know, and it's being connected there. That is the sense of safety. And that connection comes from this age and younger. You can build that connection as well. You can do it, but you can't build it as well when they're 10, 11, and 12.
Did you say you can't do it as well?
You can't do it as well. The bonding, the and there's a certain logic to it. Number one, the closer they are to the womb, which is the total enfolding of the child, the closer they are to the womb, the more that it's that sense of touch, and the bonding comes more with the touch and the feeling of the parent. As they get older and more distracted and more involved in other things and more verbal, then the verbal part plays a stronger part. That's why many children go through stages where they really move away from hugs, but they still need affirmation. You know, and then as they grow, if development is a building block. Okay? And if they don't, if children don't develop doing the jobs that they need to do early, then they have to do those jobs before they can do the other, the job of separation.
Well, this makes it sort of bad then for parents who don't know about this bonding thing. This bonding thing is a new thing on the scene, I think, in raising children. It wasn't, the word wasn't around. When I was raising mine, I didn't hear it. They're in their 30s, but I never heard of this.
Well, it's something that has come out. There's a stronger, I don't know how, you know, when it came out. I know in the early 50s is when some of the first, at least the research that I've read on bonding, we start seeing the term in the 50s. And then, and since that time, the concept of bonding, especially as it contrasts with the adolescent problem, and that's most of the research that I've read, deals with the issues around what happens within families, and then you have children who become delinquents, okay? And the bonding is a real important piece that's missing in families and where children become.
I'm just perplexed as to why I have a course at Stanford in child psychology, and we must have read 1,000 things, and I still haven't heard of this thing until recently have I heard of it. I think maybe in action, maybe some of this was done. You know, in some
of
this was happening.
I think it's a natural, it may not have been labeled that. But I think the concept of holding children, I think of probably, you know, even in the South when the nannies would raise the children, the holding is my memory of stories and stuff was that sense of holding, sitting on the lap, being a part of someone, being close to someone. That's where the bonding comes from. It's the sense of being held, especially for small children. But you see, the thing that we've learned about bonding that I don't know whether one of the things that you know, more recent research shows is it sometimes puts, like you say, puts labels on things that we've known all along, but we just haven't had a name for. When our children were real little, and I would be responsible for putting them to bed, I would go upstairs. We have a rocking chair up there where Anne-Marie, or the crib was in our bedroom, and I can remember sitting in that rocking chair and rocking Anne-Marie, and especially after she'd settled down. Before then, I would walk around the room telling her stories of Martin Luther and the Reformation. That's the way I'd get her to go to sleep. The most boring lectures I ever had in seminary and in college were about the Reformation. So anyway, I was telling these stories.
Did it take?
I don't know. She doesn't remember it, but we'll see. She's going to college the next year, so we'll see whether any of that comes
back. He doesn't know what to, what do you talk about with an infant? But he knew it was really important to talk to her, so I would come home for an evening, and he would be walking, sometimes running around the dining room, and we'd be
like
crying. He'd be in a soft voice with all this information, just saying, I have to just say something softer, so he could lecture in this Reformation stuff. It was really fun.
Well, wouldn't that be another way of bonding, though? I'm talking to them.
Let me complete my thought is that the impact of that is not just on the child. Bonding is a two-way bond. Okay, it's not just that the child feels bonded to me because of that closeness and the warmth, but I feel bonded to her. And I think that's one thing, particularly fathers, that we're relearning. Because there's been a time when fathers kind of have gotten unplugged from their children. I don't know if any of you saw it, and maybe if you've been up here, David and Karen, we got a copy of the new Time magazine, and it's on fatherhood. And I haven't gotten all the way through it yet, but I imagine that one of the things are going to, because some of the new stuff I've been reading has been, we've got to get our fathers rebonded, not so much for the children's sake, but for the father's sake. Because if a father can hold their infant and learn to hold their infant and nurture it in a close hugging way, and we can affirm, this is an important piece, and we can affirm within the father the feelings that it generates within the father, because the maleness in our culture has gotten skewed away from feeling those gentle, tender feelings. And we have to, with the, you know, there's programs in the Everett area that are wonderful programs because they deal with teen parents and they get the fathers involved. It's not just thinking teen parents as being the mother, but getting the fathers involved and giving them affirmation for the feelings of tenderness and gentleness that they have, that they have and that they need to bond with their children.
Is there more of a problem with that though, let's say 15 years ago and earlier perhaps? It seems, I see around now, being an older parent, Chris, but seeing younger parents and fathers are much more in tune and doing things every day with the kids and taking on more of a parenting role than they were.
And I think that we got caught up in the technological age, and one of the things that happened with the kind of from the Industrial Revolution on was the movement of fathers not being involved in the homes with their jobs, and so they go away to work, and then come back, and as the jobs got more and more or less and less related to who they were as people. You know, the concept of going away and coming back, and then particularly as the echelon of corporations and that kind of stuff, the hours got longer, there's less time to spend with the children. We lost because we affirmed that in the men, and that that was a direction that our culture took in terms of saying, this is what men do. It basically unplugged them. And so I hope that what you're saying is true. I like to think that it is. It's important that we get the message out, that we talk about it, and that we affirm that. Part of, at least a part of, the men's movement reaffirms the gentleness. And, you know, and some of the literature that's coming out now is real powerful literature about, or literature about female traits, or feminine traits and masculine traits. And that we all have those traits. We all have all of the traits within us. It's what traits do we want to pay attention to, and how, which traits are going to be affirmed, and which traits are going to kind of be locked on. And we have been so careful over the last 30 years for men to be affirmed only for masculine traits that we have to bring back in the feminine traits. And it's not, we're not talking, you know, we're talking the traits that are, I use it in a broad sense rather than a narrow specific sense. And it's the feelings of tenderness and gentleness and that are the primary feelings and the primary part of us that we have lost contact with.
Along that same line with what you talked about with incest as far as sexual abuse, do you have any ideas yet, or is it just so new that the men are being this nurturing, bonding soul with their children? It would seem that if they take that stance, there's probably a lot less likelihood that they'll end up in that other category.
I think that's true. And the thing that happens with bonding is also that sense of empathy. They kind of are rooted together, and that's that if this child, if I'm holding this child, and I become bonded to the warmth in that sense, and the well-being of that child becomes important to me. And the well-being of the child is that piece of empathy within me that says, I don't want anything to happen to this child that's going to hurt her. And so that it plays in that way into the other thing is that then that sense of intimacy and bonding is not just linked to sexuality. And that's another part of the concept that within our men in our society there's been a real problem with the fact that the only time that they are kind of allowed to be intimate is in a sexual way. I talked about that around the sexual abuse. Let me get down through, so, oh my goodness. I may have to have another class on this one. Okay, let me kind of move through this so I can at least get the material out, and then we can maybe have a discussion of it some other time. Finish up with providing support. Understand the nature of the individual child, understand the nature of the child and the parent. They help us to touch base with them. And understand the nature of emotional life. Moving quickly to poisonous pedagogy, we're not going to get to Abraham and Isaac. I want to read to you a list. This was, poisonous pedagogy was a concept developed by Alice Miller, and she refers to it in these books. I'll give the pitch for these. These are both in the bookstore and deal culturally with the issues around childhood trauma, particularly around child abuse situations. The one is The Untouched Key, and this deals with the arts and the flow of people who are who have been abused and the expression then of that abuse as it comes out in their art. This one called Banished Knowledge, Facing Childhood Injuries, is kind of the core book of where Alice Miller is in terms of the sense of repression and that part of us inside of us that is our child that was told to repress or that we couldn't feel certain things and the need then to how we open ourselves up to that part and to help us so that it doesn't become that hole in us and that we can fill our Swiss cheese holes. The third book I have there, I'll be looking at a little bit more this next week, is Beyond Rhetoric, New American Agenda for Children and Families. It's the final report of the National Commission on Children. And it's a good book if you're interested at all in kind of federally where the federal government is looking at going, because this is the guideline blueprint for the kinds of things that have been identified as important to the federal government. Poisonous pedagogy. Things that tend to be cultural norms about parenting. Okay? Adults are the masters, not the servants of dependent children. Adults determine in godlike fashion what is right and what is wrong for the child. Yeah. Three, the child is held responsible for their parents' anger. Four, the parents must always be shielded. Five, the child's life-affirming feelings pose a threat to the autocratic adult. Six, the child's will must be broken as soon as possible. And seven, all this must happen at a very early age so the child won't notice and will therefore not be able to expose the parents. That's what Alice Miller calls the poisonous pedagogy. She is, incidentally, is a German psychiatrist. She poses a very strong argument for the issues as to why Hitler and the Nazis could do what they did in the Second World War by using parenting pedagogy of the late 1800s as a basis to show that sense of obedience, the powerful sense of obedience that basically was unquestioned as to respond to those who were in authority. It was the clear, powerful message of all the, a book called For Your Own Good. It was one of her first major books that came out that dealt strongly with that issue. Now, in order for a culture to pass on poisonous pedagogy, there's false information that's passed off as true. And a little bit longer list, but I'll read them through fairly quickly. Number one is a feeling of duty produces love. Hatred can be done away with by forbidding it. Parents deserve respect simply because they are parents. Children are undeserving of respect simply because they are children. Obedience makes a child strong. A high degree of self-esteem is harmful. We hear that particularly associated with assertive children. People that are uncomfortable with assertive children see that as too much self-esteem. They're too, they think too highly of themselves. They kind of put themselves there. They kind of go out of their place as children. A low degree of self-esteem. This is an interesting one. A low degree of self-esteem makes a person altruistic. Means they unselfishly seek the welfare of others. tenderness or doting is harmful, especially for men. That's what comes across most strongly. Responding to a child's